Are you working on your author career but struggling to get that first book published? Does the goal of being an author seem too lofty? Or are thoughts of having multiple books and making a full-time living are as fantastical as living in Cinderella's castle? Welcome to Discovered Wordsmiths, a podcast where aspiring authors can be heard. Join Stephen Schneider as he finds and talks to authors you may not know, but authors that have gotten their foot on the author career path. Hear what they've done to get there and where they want to go now. Settle back. It's time for a bit of inspiration and advice. Come listen to today's Discovered Wordsmith.
Hi all, welcome to a new episode of Discovered Wordsmiths, and I am very excited for this episode. I've been waiting quite a while to get this one out there, and I was excited to talk to this gentleman. Let me give you a little update. One of the things in my life has always been computers. I had an Atari the year they came out, I got a Commodore 64, I played games, and I learned to program, which led to the rest of my life choices of going to school, learning computers, and eventually going into lots of different computer-related industries and jobs. I've repaired computers. I'm administrator. I've run a whole IT department, and I love to do development, writing code, software. Obviously, having an Atari the year they came out, being into computers, learning to code, games have always been a part of my life, video games. I've made a few games on my own for fun, nothing huge, started on the Commodore, wrote a few things, actually did one for a school project. And lately, I've gotten back into that a bit because I enjoy that type of development, that type of coding. But I've also been working on my author career. I've been working on writing. So several different creative avenues. What I've been really struggling with is figuring out how to combine the two sides of my life, the computers and development and the writing, the non-computer part of it. Then it struck me, and I'll thank Zach Bohannon for this. Inadvertently, he didn't do it as an idea, but talking to him about video games, I suddenly realized, hey, video games nowadays have stories, and they actually have people that write those stories. So I started looking into it more and realized that this was something that fit right in with my life, with both computers and writing. It is a job that is available without many people having the qualifications and skills to do that job. So I thought it would be something perfect for me to work on to help teach the next generation, the middle school kids now. That's been my focus all along, is working with middle school kids, teaching them how to write. Now I'm expanding that in teaching them how to write for video games, create stories that are used in video games. So, of course, immediately I started looking people up and seeing who was out there. And I ran across a name, Evan Skolnick. That's who I'm talking to today. And I was very excited that he graciously agreed to talk to me and has answered emails and all sorts of things. He's a great guy. He's worked on some very professional video games, Ultimate Alliance 2, Cuphead, the Telltale Walking Dead games. So he does have the experience behind him. So while this is a author podcast and the interviews deal with authors and their books, and Evan does have a book out that we do talk about, this one's a little different in what we're talking about because video game storytelling is way different than writing for a novel. You can use some of the skills to get you started, but there's different things you have to do. And we talk about some of that in the interview. But in the future, I am going to be working on releasing articles and videos and blog posts and talking more and more about creating story in video game. So for any parents and teachers that have been listening, or if you ran across this very specific episode, I am going to be providing more learning materials and more examples of how kids can learn the skill of writing stories that will be used in video games to give them something they could use for work, a job, a life, a career, passion, all of that in the future. So anyway, that's kind of a little bit of an update of what I've been doing and a little bit of an intro to this wonderful podcast with Evan. So why don't we take it away, Evan? All right, Evan, let's officially greet you. Welcome to the podcast, Discovered Wordsmiths. It's really great to talk to you. How are you doing today, besides tech moments?
Doing fine, thanks. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, great. Okay, so you're a different person to chat with. Usually I talk to new authors who have a book out. We are talking for something completely different. So I'm really excited because it is a different direction. It's something that a lot of my author friends don't know much about. So before we get into that, tell everybody a little bit about yourself outside of work life, some of the things you like to do, where you live, that type of thing.
I live in the San Francisco Bay Area with my lovely wife and two sons who are away at college. So we're just getting the taste of being empty nesters now, which is interesting. Yeah. But I love spending time with my family. Big baseball fan, especially Red Sox fan. Go Red Sox. I'm from the Northeast, so watching the playoffs now with bated breath. And I like playing video games, as you might expect, and also board, especially with my old high school buddies. We're spread across the country now, but we play online just about every week to stay in touch and have fun together. And I play drums. Not well at all, but I do it for fun. And it's one of the things that I do that I have no intention of getting any good at, and that's not the point. So
yeah, I play some drums. We just set up a drum set for my stepson. He wants to play.
Nice. Electronic, I hope.
No. Okay. We got it from a friend, so it's a starter kit. It's an old fashioned.
Okay, I started on a beater kit as well, and all I will say is use ear protection, because I did not, and I regret it.
I used to have a kit growing up, so I know how loud they are. My son, who's a little older than my stepson, had a kit, and I know how loud they get. So not going into it blind.
Or deaf, I hope, is actually the one.
You know, that starts coming with age after you've been playing for a while.
Yeah. Well, I used to play really loud drum room in our basement and when we used to live in upstate New York. And after I'd play, my ears would be ringing. I'd be like, hey, that was a good session. My ears are ringing. And then one day it just never stopped ringing. And I was like, that probably was a mistake.
Right. Yeah. It's not till you're older that you realize what you shouldn't have done when you were younger.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's always the way, isn't it? But yeah, that's what I like to do when I'm not doing my job.
Your job. Okay. So let's hit on that for a moment. Tell everybody a little bit about what your job is and also what your job has been.
Okay. My job, I have two jobs these days. I'm a game writer and narrative designer for video games. And I'm also a professor of practice teaching the same subject. So teaching game writing and narrative design to the next generation of video game writers and narrative designers. In the past, I've worked at Marvel Comics as a writer and editor. I've been in games for about 20 years now. I came in as a producer, so managing the process. But very early on, I noticed that the narrative elements could definitely use some support. And I began providing that support based on my previous career as a writer and editor. And so that just became more and more what I did. And now I do it full time. It's all I do. It's all I focus on in the industry is game writing and narrative design. I do. Sometimes that crosses over into game design somewhat, but mostly the storytelling.
So obviously this is not like writing a book. And it's something that has grown through the years. I don't imagine they had game writers and narrative writers when they made Space Invaders.
No.
So what exactly is a game writer and a narrative writer when it comes to modern video?
Well, a game writer and narrative designer are two very closely related roles, but they aren't quite the same. So I'll start with what a game writer does. A game writer, as you might expect, writes the story for the game. All the things that some of the more traditional skills that you would expect to need to have as a writer in any medium. So, you know, how to tell stories, how to develop worlds, how to develop characters and write dialogue and all those things. That's what game writers tend to do. So that's more traditional things that are probably easier to get one's head around. And then narrative designers are the ones who are folks who try to figure out how to make this, how to marry this to gameplay. And when you're working on a project as a game writer, you're going to be doing some narrative design. It's almost inevitable. And if you're a narrative designer, you better know how to write. Because you have to understand how stories actually work to make them work in gameplay. So there are two separate roles at many places, although in a smaller team, one person will probably do both of those things combined. And like I said, there's overlap. There's always overlap. So basically, it's the narrative design part of the process that is really particularly different. Game writing itself has some things that are very different from writing a novel or a screenplay or a comic book or anything else. Those are all different from each other, but game writing is like way out here. It's got some things that are similar, but it's got so many things that are so fundamentally different and need it took me a long time to understand those differences. And so now I try to help young writers and other folks learn that much more quickly than I did.
Got it. And this is where I think most people would get confused. I understand story in a book or a TV show. You introduce characters, you set up a conflict, they go after the bad guy or whatever it happens to be, there's obstacles, and you get a conclusion at the end where the good guys win. Basic, you know, idea. Where video games are interactive and it could change and it could be a completely different ending than that. So I assume you're not sitting down and writing a story like it's going to be a published book. So how's that work? How do you do that with a video game that's so interactive?
Yeah. So you've intuitively, hit the nail on the head there with regard to, you don't just sit down and start writing a story. Usually you come on after the train has already left the station as a writer. So in other words, the team has an idea for a world. They have an idea for a setup. They have an idea for, the most importantly, the mechanics of the game, the things you'll be doing, the things you can do, the things the game will allow you to do as a player. And those are the mechanics. And so there's usually a context and a concept. And they may even have figured out the story on their own, or at least a story. And then often someone like me comes in and they're like, can you help us make this good? And not always. Sometimes we're involved early on, but it almost never starts with, we're going to make a story. This is what a lot of writers who I know from other media were like, hey, I want to be a game writer. What should I do? I've got an idea for a great game story. Who do I bring it to? And it's like, that's not how it works. It is how it works in novels and movies and any other media where the story comes first and everything serves that story. It's not the case in games most of the time, almost all the time. So the way it works is you come in and try to enhance and contextualize what the team probably already has worked out the basics of. And you're going to be going with the mechanics. So in other words, you'll figure out, what can the player do? That's the first questions. The first questions I ask is, what can the player do? Because we'll build the story around that activity, as opposed to, I'm going to write a story and now make a game around that story, which we've seen games like that. They're called the old movie games. Maybe you've played a few of those,
right,
where the story was dictated before the gameplay and the team has to figure out, okay, how do I turn this story into compelling gameplay? And they usually weren't very good games because of that, because right, they were not leading with their strength, which is gameplay. And players come to play a game. And as a writer in this industry, one of the first things you have to understand is understanding your lane and your role in the process. And it is not a leading role. You are in a support role. And that's a very strange place for a writer to be. And it, because they're used to leading the charge and everyone serving story. It's all about the story. And that's not usually the case in games. The stories can be very important in some games. In other games, it's not so important at all. But it just right, needs to be there. And that's also a variance. You don't. And the audience is split sometimes as well with regard to those who are interested in the story and those who couldn't care at all, couldn't care less. And I'm sure you've never walked into a movie theater back in the 4 days when we used to go to movie theaters full of people, and before the film starts, and you might hear someone talking in front of you, some people talking with each other, and you're probably not likely to hear someone say to their friend, I hope there's not too much story in this movie. But we have people like that playing our games sometimes. So not all of them, probably not even a majority, but there are always some that are like, look, just get this out of my way. I'm going to skip this cutscene, this little movie, to get to more gameplay, because that's what I came here for. So understanding that and going with it as opposed to fighting it is one of the most important lessons for becoming a game writer or narrative designer, especially.
Okay. That's,
and there are other elements that are different too, but that's probably one of the biggest ones is that, like you said, it's interactive. So you're letting someone into your story that you don't have control over. Like when you write a novel, you have complete control over everything that happens. Right. I know that sometimes we develop characters to such an effect that they basically tell us what they would do and what they won't do.
Right.
But in this case, there actually is someone in your story that you don't have control over, not full control over. And not only that, we have to cater to that person, that player. And so that's, again, a very different way of thinking when it comes to storytelling.
Yeah, because I know I've been just trying to figure it out, thinking about it, and I'm like, okay, that's like crazy thing. I'm used to reading a book, writing a story, watching a movie or TV show. They're very linear. But okay, so let's, like, Ultimate Alliance. You worked on Ultimate Alliance 2, and you mentioned cutscenes. So I can see that. Ultimate Alliance had cutscenes, some good story, a little play almost, and it led up to where the conflict was, and that was the next section the player got to play. So as a writer, I'm assuming you helped write the cutscene, who says what, and the flow of that. But then you got to stop where the action takes place and let the player take over. So at that level, what's the writer do with the designer and the level programmer?
Yeah, so Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, most games of that age, and even today, we would work. The storytelling doesn't stop when the player gets on the sticks, as we call it, starts playing. The storytelling is continuing, but it's happening through gameplay. And the cutscenes you mentioned, the little miniature, little movies that kind of bridge between gameplay experiences, those are often there because those are things that we can't do in gameplay. We need to take control for a bit to show a character's expression and to force the story in a certain direction to say to the player, put the controller down for a second. We're going to be steering you in this direction now. And the players, you know, generally are okay with that for a limited amount of time, like a minute or two. And then after that, you're really pushing your luck. So they want to get back into gameplay. But the storytelling does not stop when you start playing. And that is where narrative design really comes in, because then how do we weave the story in even as you're playing, even as we don't make you let go of the controller, even as you are doing whatever you want to do in the level, how do we continue to weave the story elements and keep you, most importantly, understanding what you're supposed to be doing and why? And the why is especially what we bring to the table. The game will tell you, you need to beat these enemies, you need to move to this location. And that's the core of what they're doing. But we have to layer in, well, these enemies are these people, and this is why you're fighting them, this is why they're trying to stop you, and this is the thing you're trying to get, and it is here because of that reason, and the reason you need to do this is because if you don't, blah, blah, blah. So that's all the why, but at the core of it, it's simply, the game is simply saying, basically defeat these enemies and move to this location, and then I will let you move forward. That's all the game is doing. So we are layering all this additional content. It is a story-driven game, and it is a very important role, but it is not the core role. The core role is that mechanically fun? Is it fun to defeat these enemies, or is it engaging? Is it compelling, or is it boring after a few minutes? And if it is, narratively, we can't help it. One of the things that I say is that storytelling can make a good game great, but it can't make a bad game good. So if the gameplay is terrible, no one's going to experience your story. So we have to go with them and enhance that experience and, again, contextualize it. So that's what we do, working with the level designers and with the game designers, hopefully hand in glove, so that experience feels very smooth and it has a lot of continuity. So when you go into a cutscene, it feels exactly like you came out of gameplay and there's no jarring like disconnect.
Okay.
If we can avoid them.
So I imagine you got your cutscene, gathering your team, the helicarriers under attack, go fight the minions, and then it's the level. And at that point, I would assume you turn it mostly over to the level designer, because you're not going to say they climb down a ladder and there's five henchmen to fight. That's more up to the level designer. But you would say they need to get to the control room to turn off the computer so they can open the door and fight the big bad guy. Mm-hmm. But you don't necessarily say what hallways they're going down. You don't write it like a story narrative.
Right. Well, like you said, we'll have the big beats in there, like that. Like you have to get to the control room and prevent the helicarrier from crashing. And we're going to, however they do that is up to you, level designer. But then as they design that level, we're still going to be involved writing dialogue to support that goal, writing voiceover you might hear along the way, and creating other narrative events that might happen once the level designer begins to map out the details. We'll still be involved so that you get that kind of very smooth experience that the player feels like it's all unified. So we don't fully step back. And conversely, for our cutscenes are not the level design, or the designers are also heavily involved in that, because we are bridging between their levels, between their experiences that the player's going to be involved in. So it has to be, when it works best, everyone's involved in everything to a degree. Obviously, we take over the dialogue writing, but they might say, we need something like this here because the player needs to know this, because we're going to be dropping this thing in the level. So we're like, okay, let's work together on this. And then we'll actually write the dialogue and they'll trigger it. And actually, the designers will be the ones who will actually make the code that triggers the dialogue to happen under certain circumstances. So it is very much collaborative. And that's another aspect of game development that's so important to understand, is that it is very collaborative. It's not write a script and walk away and hand it off to a team. It is very much you're in the thick of it. When it's working right, you're in the thick of it the whole time. And it's a very changing landscape as well. Another important thing to understand about game writing is that it's not all writers solve narrative problems and then find the next day, you know what, I thought of a better solution, I'm going to change it. But we will solve a problem, then come into the office and say, I got it. And they'll go, oh yeah, that level was cut, so don't worry about that. You're like, what? It is, I call it riding like in a rodeo. You simply are simply trying to hang on as this thing is continually changing and morphing and trying to kick you off, by the way, because it only wants to be a game. It does not want to be a story. Staying with it and actually steering it still in the general direction you want it to go. So it's a very different kind of writing experience, and it's exhilarating. But then again, I used to have hair before all this started.
Yeah, I was just talking to a friend of mine that we agreed that I used to have hair before I had kids. So
yeah, that may have been it too. I'm not sure. Right. All I know is I used to have hair.
So that sounds crazy to me. So I imagine as you're writing, again, Ultimate Alliance is a great example, that at no point at the beginning are you writing a complete story and all these cutscenes and then, hey, let's use these. You might write level 2 and then tomorrow level 13 and 15, but then 15 might get moved and you might have to rewrite. So it's almost like a new writer figuring out how to write and moving things around. It sounds very chaotic.
No, we have mapped out the whole story at the beginning. Okay. Like, but not in a vacuum is the point. We've worked with designers. What you usually see is once it's known what the mechanics are, what the player can do, the writers and the designers in an optimal situation will work together to map out the entire story. Okay. Mission by mission, level by this. Of course, we're talking about a single player contained game experience, which is not an assumption we can make anymore because of games have continued to evolve and we see many other things there. But let's just say we're talking about a single player game and with a beginning, middle, and end. Yeah, we don't just make it up as we go along. We have a plan. But then once you start drilling down into the specifics of this mission or this level or even this part of the game, you'll find that, you know what, that mechanic isn't working. We can't make it work. We can't make it engaging. We're going to change this entire, we need to change the entire level to something else. And we need to change the story along with it. Or we need to cut this level. Now this thing that we thought we were going to doing between chapter 1 and chapter 3 isn't happening. So how do we bridge that gap now? So it's not that we didn't have a plan. It's not that we make it up as we go along and do it out of order. But it's more that it is a plan, and that's all it is. It's not a blueprint. And it has to be flexible and ready to respond to all kinds of feedback, not only from the game's success management and focus testing, players playing the game and finding that they like this more than that. It's just like us, it's a constant iteration. In games, we iterate. We prototype, we test, we take notes, and we change the plan. And so the narrative, even though there was a plan, that we have to, I'm sorry, I've got a cat invading my space. We have to be really flexible and be aware that it's going to be like riding the bull or riding an earthquake, and just the ground's not going to be stable. And you just got to be ready to be frustrated with solving things that become irrelevant the next week, or having a brand new problem that you had no idea was coming. It's just not the same.
That definitely sounds like, if you're the right person, the right mindset, that sounds like a very exciting and fun thing to do. And I can definitely see every day waking up, what do I get to work on today, even if it changes?
Right. That's the thing. You know, people ask me, what was my typical day like as a game writer? And I say, there is no such thing. And not only from studio to studio, I work with many different studios over the years, and they all have different ways of doing things. They have their own jargon for things. There are some shared tools and things that you will see again and again. But basically, it's not like walking into a movie studio where a gaffer is always a gaffer and they always do the exact same job. They use the same tools. And if you've been a gaffer on one production, you're going to be the same job on another production. Even if it's a science fiction one case and a historical romance the next, it's the same job. But in games, the titles and the specifics of the role quite a bit from studio to studio and the culture to culture and the tools they use as well. Yeah, it's not like uniform, and it's still being invented. What's the exciting part is that we're still figuring out new ways to tell stories in games that have never been attempted before. And it's like an open landscape. So it's exciting, but it is also can be frustrating at times. And I try to, when I teach my students about game writing and trying to prepare them for this, I throw exercises at them that try to stimulate this situation and the fact that you often don't get to choose the kind of intellectual property you're working on or the type of game you're working on. You don't get to come in before the mechanics have been decided. You basically try to simulate all these things to thicken their skin and toughen them up for the reality that I hope waits them if they want to grab it. But yeah, that's the reality is that it's very divorced in many ways from traditional writing.
Got it. And I want to come back to your teaching, but before we do, you've worked on different types of games, which I found really exciting. So how is what we just talked about with Ultimate Alliance and writing for that story compared to The Walking Dead from Telltale, which I thought were great games. I loved all those, but they're not action. They're not fast paced. It's definitely a story with a little bit of choose your own elements, but you had to hit a certain spot to move on to chapter 2. So how are those different? And how was it working on Walking
Dead? The Walking Dead season 1 is the one that kind of broke Telltale open to the world and was a huge game. I had nothing to do with that, so I won't take any credit. I worked on one of the later series that was a follow-up. So I don't want people to think that I was involved in that first season. I wish I could claim I was, but I wasn't. But some very smart people were, some friends of mine, and they just did some things that are really clever. Telltale had been around for a while, and if you played their earlier games, they felt a bit like Choose Your Own Adventure. But with The Walking Dead Season 1, they did several new things they had never done before. They had never done an M-rated, very serious title like that before, and they added a few new mechanics. And what I understood from the inside once I got to Telltale that I didn't understand from the outside, and most people don't notice, is that the gameplay in those games is not the walking around trying to find the key to open the door to move to the next level. It is not the shooting galleries that they pop in once in a while or anything like that. It's not the gameplay. I most people think that's the gameplay, and it's, it's very light gameplay. The gameplay is the conversation wheel.
Yes.
The gameplay is making those choices, and most importantly, the relationships and how they're affected by those choices. The game story generally doesn't branch that much. We generally don't branch game stories that much because it's hugely expensive to do so, to basically make two or three totally separate games. You notice in Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, we branch, but then we fold back to a unit because otherwise we're making two games and we're splitting our efforts and the player will only see half of our efforts. The Telltale games are the same way, but that is the focus of the gameplay in the Telltale game. So it's a very different, the example you happen to choose is very different from most traditional video games, even though it looks like a video game. It doesn't, under the hood, it's not really much like a video game in many ways. So what's different about that is that everything in the Telltale experience was about those choices, and those relationship management is what it came down to. And that's not what is the core of most video games. So working on Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, yes, we presented, a major choice to the player, which was choose a side in the superhero Civil War. The comics had only let you choose a side in your head, but our game was going to let you choose a side and actually fight for that side in the game. So we had to, but there were some similarities there with regards to choice design. And how do we make this choice feel balanced? How do we make sure players don't feel like they're being railroaded to one or the other or have any particular gameplay advantages of choosing one or the other? Let them express it's like a moral choice and it's a philosophical choice. That was similar. But then once you get past that, the telling a story in a game like Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, what I would say is a AA console title, is very different because you've got a much, much bigger budget. It's a longer experience. And the production values tend to be higher and a lot more emphasis on action gameplay that you have to contextualize. Yeah, Telltale is an outlier among the projects I've worked on in terms of what's actually happening under the hood. Whereas if you come Mua 2, which is what I call Marvel Ultimate Alliance 2, and like Cuphead, which I worked on.
Yes.
Cuphead was was a great experience, but it was one of those cases where this team had already done most of the story work already. They knew the story they wanted to tell. They had their characters, their world. They had the structure of that game, but they knew they were going to need someone to come in and really polish it and help them with their storybook cutscenes. They didn't have animated cutscenes. They had like a storybook opening, like you have in the beginning of Snow White with an actual physical storybook. So they want to have it feel like you're going into a 1930s storybook and then a 1930s cartoon. So I was, and there was no voice in that game. So the characters were not going to be voiced. So I had to get it across in the word balloons and whatnot, captions. And so I came in very late. I basically came in, the game was largely done. I had to help them tweak things here and there and write all the dialogue for all the characters. But there isn't that much dialogue in that game versus like a Mua 2. So it's a similar skill set, but you have to understand this is a different genre of game. Story is much less important to this game than it is like an action RPG like Marvel. So you have to go, okay, I'm going to step back and I'm going to make sure the things I do do what they need to do and not get in the way of the gameplay, which is the core thing. So that the gameplay is almost always the core thing. But in Cuphead's case, again, as I said, some games and game genres lean more heavily on the story quality than others. And some like Cuphead, I don't take any credit for that game's huge success, but I'm glad that I was able to be part of it. And I'm glad that the game feels like a 1930s experience through and through, including the way characters talk.
Yeah, that,
which is a big part of what I brought to the table.
Yeah, that Cuphead's brutal game. That's one I have not finished. I'm not that good of a game player. But I was going to ask about
that. I'm not going to claim that I did either.
You probably actually got to see some of the ones I haven't seen. But I was going to ask about that because the opening cutscene, the story leading up to why you're playing the game, that was basic story. But then any individual boss within that game didn't really like advance the character arc, didn't move the story along. It was go defeat this boss and souls and this boss and souls. So it was very much almost an old fashioned classic arcade game, what it came down to. So what you just said, I was like, okay, I can see that. And then Walking Dead, I know a lot of people loved it and a lot of people didn't. I liked it, but I could see it as you basically did write a story for that one. The minor choices didn't necessarily change the outcome. It just changed sometimes the reactions people had. Is that accurate?
Yeah, there are other things that would change too, things that programmatically weren't that difficult to do. So, for example, I don't want to spoil too much, but there's a point in the original Walking Dead season one where you have to choose, you've been bitten by a walker, and you have to decide whether to cut off your arm or not. And if you choose to cut off your arm, you walk around the rest of the game with, because you chose to do that. And if you don't, you take a risk that maybe something terrible happens. That's a programmatic change where they can swap in different model on the fly pretty easily. But not easy. I'm not going to say it's easy, because who do I know, I'm a programmer, but they could do it. As opposed to writing an entire other story, which they did not do. So things like that, changing the conversations, changing who's in the scene, those are things that we can swap in without changing everything. And they make the player feel like the choices they're making are having an effect on the world. And that's the core thing, is we call it the illusion of choice. So we cannot give you true choice in most games, because it would be massively expensive to develop that. And the player would only ever see a tiny bit of the game. We generally provide the illusion of choice. We can do small things that make you feel like, yes, my choices are having an effect on the world. Characters are talking to me differently. They're saying things, different things to me. Then they're making note of things I do. Things look different, possibly, slightly. But under the hood, it's the same structure in place, which is very expensive to develop and balance and debug and things.
Okay. So talking about big games, I see you've got Battlefront on your portfolio. Totally different game than the ones we've been talking about. It's an open, basically FPS shooter. You got two teams fighting and killing each other. And that's really the gameplay. So what, as a game writer, were you involved with for the story aspects of that?
Yeah, and it wasn't really, the first game didn't really have a story. So I came in to write dialogue, lots of dialogue. So a game like that, and Lua 2 and many other big games with lots of characters and combat, you'll often have what we call barks, which is, or systemic dialogue. So this is another kind of writing that does not exist in any other medium, basically. And this is, if you're running around in Battlefront and you hear, to our left, or I'm reloading, or look out, or grenade. Those are things that if you play it again, you won't hear those same lines. You'll hear different lines depending on what's happening. So they are systemic. They are system-based. They are playing or not playing depending on what's actually happening in real time. And we have to write multiple copies, multiple variations of each trigger, we call it. So if a line is triggered by an event, so for example, if one of your teammates is throwing what they call them in Star Wars, a detonator.
Thermal detonators.
Thermal detonator. I'm throwing, throwing detonator. Detonator out. I had to write like 20 versions of that line, because it may happen many times. And the worst thing that can happen is you hear the same exact line twice within a short amount. Because right. That breaks you. Suddenly it feels like it's not a real world anymore. People don't do that. And if you hear that, it breaks the immersion. So we have to write multiple variants of all these different trigger lines to cover that. And so this is how you can get tens of thousands of lines in a game. And you'll only hear a few hundred perhaps in a play session, because it's a bank of lines that the game is pulling from dynamically to make your experience feel real. And so on Battlefront, that's mostly what I did. I also wrote a fun attract mode thing with C-3PO and R2-D2. If you don't touch the controller for a while in the main menu, they'll start wandering around this white space, and 3PO is bashing R2 on the heads, calling him a rust bucket, and all the great Star Wars things I got to write for that. Nice. But basically, it was mostly the dialogue, and there were thousands of lines of barks of a systemic dialogue to support this combat, which you might play for hours and hours, and hopefully not hear the same exact line, twice, at least not over a long period of time.
So what it all boils down to, what I hear, is game writer does not mean following the beats and creating a story arc necessarily. You work with designers a lot. You probably had to learn a little bit more about game design. It's got a lot more to it than a novel. You could almost look at novelists and say, really, that's all you got to do?
Right. Yeah. Novel writing is probably one of the less useful backgrounds to come into games. A screenplay writer might be better equipped, because they write for the screen. They show the show don't tell, all that stuff. They are not going to be in the character's heads. So novelists have the luxury of being in your heads, and also having a completely unlimited budget, right? Novelists can write whatever they want. It doesn't cost any more to describe a million spaceships versus one spaceship. But in our game, if I said I want a million spaceships all uniquely designed, they'd run me out of the studio. The pitchforks would come out. So a screenplay writer or a TV writer, someone who's written with a budget in mind and for the screen, is probably closer, to being ready for something like that. As a novelist is going to, If that's all they've done, it's going to be real challenging to get your head around a lot of different things at once. The same way novelists switching to the screen is an adjustment. Because again, you're not in the character's head. You're not describing their thoughts. Everything must be shown if possible. And you've got very limited budget as to where you can go, what you can do. These are a lot of the same things we deal with in games. But then you layer on in games all these additional things I just talked about on top of all that. At least with someone who's written for the screen, when I'm looking at writers who want to come from the outside into games, generally people who have written for the screen are going to be closer to getting their head around a lot of the other constraints that we work under.
Okay, so let me ask, if somebody's listening to this, they love video games, a younger person, and they say, that sounds cool. I didn't know they actually had people as story writers for video games. What would you tell them they should start looking at or doing to get prepared? Maybe they're 15 or even in college now or something.
Yeah, one of the first things that I wrote a blog on this on my website. So it's How Does One Become a Game Writer? It's aimed, you know, at anyone who's interested, possibly converting from another writing into another writing track, or just a young person who wants to investigate this. And the long and the short of it is that it is great to practice those skills and to look at tools like RenPy and Twine, which are very easy to learn tools for creating branching storylines without having to worry about a budget. Episode Mobile, which I worked, helped to develop the prototype that led to that platform. And you can write your own stories on there with little, you know, characters walking around, talking with each other, making choices without really having a lot of technical knowledge. Those are all good places to start. But I also very much recommend that any young person who's seriously interested in becoming a game writer or narrative designer should make sure they're bringing something else, because it's become very competitive. A lot of people want to do this. And it's a very difficult first job in the industry to get. You're more likely to get a different job in the industry and then pivot over to that, which is what I did. And I see that working more often than someone who has is only studied game writing. That's all they've studied. This is all I want to do. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's a very specialized role. There are much fewer openings for them versus, like, for example, a more generic role like designer or producer or even QA, you know, quality assurance, testing games at a professional level. And I've often seen people who start in that role and then move over to the narrative side once they're within the walls of a studio, because people think they can write. Everyone thinks they can write. And because people don't want to learn how to program or do 3D modeling, because those are very high barriers to get into games, writing is seen as a relatively soft target by many people. Like, well, I know how to write. I know how to open a Word document. No one can stop me from typing a story. We see this in all kinds of media, not just games. But because of that, there's so many people who believe they can do this, and a lot of people who can do this. I recommend, if you're really serious about game writing in particular, that you train yourself up as someone who can do something else too. So, for example, in the game writing program where I teach at the University of Silicon Valley, our program teaches the students who choose to be in this concentration, the game writing concentration, are trained first and foremost as game designers with a writing focus. So I'm the one who handles the writing focus part. So I put them through the ringer. But I teach them the 3X structure, Hero's Journey. I teach it to all the students actually in the game program, because they're all going to be part of the storytelling process. But then the students who go deeper into this game writing one, game writing two, narrative design leadership, and that's where I teach them those other skills. But meanwhile, they're learning game design, they're learning level design, they're learning how to use Unity and Unreal, and they're becoming qualified game designers. Or in some cases, they are game engineers, game programmers who have an interest in storytelling, and they use these courses as electives. The point is that they could go out and apply for a game programming job or a game design job, which are much more plentiful out there and more likely to be able to break in, whereas the game writing jobs are more specific and really just very challenging to break in as your first job in the industry.
So multiple skills helped, definitely. So you mentioned game design. What exactly is a game designer compared to a writer, a programmer? Because I would think, a game designer, and it's the programmer. But there's different jobs. So what exactly is a game designer?
Yeah, there was a time when that was all one job, right? When games first started and we only had 64K of memory to deal with, one person, you can only put so much in a game anyway. But now the roles have become so specialized because we can put so much content in the game. So game programming and game design are two different things. Game designers are the ones who conceptualize what you'll be doing, the mechanics of the gameplay, the rules of the game, and in many cases, the narrative context and conceit. And in fact, for a long time, game designers doing the story stuff was just another thing on their long list of things to do until that became more specialized in the last 10 or 15 years where we didn't. When I came into the industry 20 years ago, there was no such thing as a game writer or a narrative designer. It didn't exist, which is why I became a producer. I didn't see any other role for myself in the industry. That has evolved. So that's breaking out from design itself. But design is basically the ideas for the game, the rules, balance, and the mechanics, laying out levels in some cases. Again, within design, there were different roles within design. So there's level designers, there's combat designers, there's, you know, economy designers, like for in-game economy, all kinds of different roles within that role. And then programmers, of course, are the ones who actually make it work. So they're the ones who are doing the engineering that actually executes on these designs and these systems. And so we all rely on programmers to make the games actually function. If I can write as much dialogue as I want, but if no one triggers it, if the game can't make it play, what's the point? Programmers are just what you expect. They are the ones that are working all that code under the hood and making everything actually happen.
Okay. So you mentioned your course that you teach. Tell us a little more about that, because like you said, 20 years ago, this didn't even exist. So there's really no courses to become a Bachelor's of Arts in Game Design and Narrative Writing. So tell us a little bit about the course and a little more about what you do and anything that's really cool about it.
Yeah. But there are loads of game design programs across the country at university level, but there are very few that have any kind of focus on narrative. Some might have a single course or a single module within a course. There are definitely fewer than like 10 universities across the world, probably more like 6, that actually have more than just one course, having an actual track in narrative that is designed to complement, you know, a game design degree or other kind of game-related degree. And ours is one of them. So the idea of it is to teach them how to be writers. So the core track is the main bulk of the major is still, it's not a major. In other words, it's a game design major. So they're still learning all the things I talked about, how to design games, how to work in the tools and make levels and balance games and think of ideas for mechanics, things like that. And then these students will have a series of courses that are designed to also make them very competent writers and game writers and narrative designers. So there's a course called Introduction to Game Storytelling. That is, every student in the entire game program has to take it because, again, they're all going to be storytellers. And so the basis of that course is my book, Video Game Storytelling, which is essentially designed to teach game developers of all stripes the basics of storytelling. Because I found that a team that doesn't understand storytelling, I can't babysit 200 people with regard to the narrative decisions they're making at their desks every day, because they do make decisions that they don't even realize are affecting the narrative. That course is everybody. But then the students who want to go further with this, the spine courses of this concentration are script writing. So I teach them how to write for the screen, how to write short films, and how to understand larger films, and how to write in the screenplay format. And then there's a game writing one, which simulates being a junior writer in the industry, doing common tasks that a junior writer will end up doing, like writing barks and working on someone else's IP, not your own. And then game writing two, we teach them how to actually develop their own IP, their own world, and begin writing for it. And then narrative design and leadership, how to manage the nuts and bolts of a simulated large game project from a narrative point of view and making decisions, and also mentoring junior writers. So I connect that fourth course with the game writing one course students. So they're interacting. The students who have made their own IP are now sending assignments to the junior writers in the first game writing course so that we have that kind of interaction, which I think is really valuable. And the students seem to really like that.
I love that, because back in the day when I was in Boy Scouts, that was a key tenet, was the older scouts that know the skills teach the younger ones, and it's a cycle. So doing that, I think, is really cool.
And both sides learn from that process. That's not a one-way street.
Yeah, I was talking to someone else about that. If you've never taught something, you should, because you learn so many things teaching.
That's why I do it. That's why I do it. I'm still learning from my students all the time and learning how to teach. So if the student in the upper-level class sends a specification to the young lower class, the lower-level class, and they don't get back what they wanted, I say, well, let's look at your specification. You weren't very specific here, were you? You left it open here, and in another place, you left it. You were too prescriptive, and you didn't allow them to play. You didn't give them any room to be creative. So that is a learning process as well. So yeah, definitely two-way street.
And I love how you mentioned that teach like hero's journey and the basic structures. Even if they're not writing a whole story and following all the beats, that's the basis still. You got to know that. So even in the gameplay, the interactive, you got to have that built. Games are boring if the very first thing you do is the big battle, and then the rest of it is just walking around picking up items and stuff.
Yeah, and they intuitively, what I tell students when I start teaching that particular course is the things I'm going to teach you in this course, you probably pretty much already know. You just didn't know that because the audience knows you don't start off with the final boss, and the players and the designers know that, but the answer is why. And also just provides a shared language of story. So in other words, when I mention an inciting incident, we all know what we're talking about. Or I mentioned an act two break, or the things that are kind of Hollywood parlance and things that traditional writers are very conscious of. A game programmer might not realize that, but they have an effect on it. Having that shared language of story that the team understands is the goal of my book, which is based on a bunch of tutorials I gave at the Game Developers Conference and continue to give. And now these classes, especially that first class, because I have found, like I said, that if I am speaking a language that is foreign to the entire team with regard to story, they go back scratching their heads to their desks. It's not going to get a good result. So I like to try to prep the team with these concepts so that we are speaking the same language. Not necessarily they're going to be the, and they're going to be the ones that are going to be executing at the in the actual game, not me. So I can help them. I can help them make a plan, but they have to have some instincts themselves. No, Tony, come on.
He's a very pretty cat. Large. Thank you. He's a man.
She's a big girl.
You mentioned your book, which I've been reading, by the way. Since this is a podcast for authors, tell us a little bit about the book. Obviously, it's nonfiction.
Yeah, so it like much of my career, it was not a plan to write a book. What happened was I was giving these tutorials at GDC every year, the Game Developers Conference, largest conference for game developers ever in the world every year. And people share all kinds of knowledge. You'd be amazed how much knowledge people share about what went wrong on their previous projects and what they're working on now, as much as they can reveal, but best practices and things like that. And so I felt I want to teach everyone how to be better storytellers, because I was finding that I need the team to be better storytellers, not just not just bring someone like me on board to help shepherd the process, but because I can't babysit everybody. I can't look over everyone's shoulder. I want them to have better narrative instinct. So I began giving these tutorials at GDC and for years and years. And I thought, someone mentioned to me, you should probably maybe think about turning this into a book. I thought, yeah, that would be great, except that would be a lot of work. And I'd have to find an agent and I'd have to, you know, pitch it around and write a proposal. And being an inherently lazy person, I just didn't make that happen. And then I was just at a certain point, a Penguin Random House imprint contacted me and said, hey, we're looking for books to fill this line. And we think your tutorial would make a great book. Yes, it would. And I can skip about three steps I just mentioned. So we were off and running. And so it came out in 2014. It takes the concepts of this day-long tutorial I have been giving and expands on them. And then it's the whole idea of it is it's a very affordable, quick read. It's not a big compendium. It's the first half is basically an overview of how stories work in general. And then the second half is how does this relate to games? And so it's really aimed at not game writers, not narrative designers, but everyone else in the team to provide that common ground and that common language.
Yeah, I've been reading it and I was very, wow, look, I know the hero's journey. And it's really story stuff you got to work on. But I imagine it was difficult to work on it because it's very static and linear. That's totally different than what you're probably used to writing for games.
I mean, writing a book?
Yeah.
I used to write for comics and I've written for other media too. So right. I still remember how to write in that form and not have to jump around. But and those principles still apply to games. Most games are pretty linear. The fact is that, like I said, we will change things here and there along the way. We might give you a different ending toward the end, but fully branched games are very rare because of the expense. So we do think in terms of the three-act structure. We do think in terms of traditional forms, but then we have to go further and realize that we can't. The players are looking for story that's going to contextualize their experience. But yeah, it was. And just because you've got a bunch of PowerPoints, dropping them into the page doesn't really... It was a lot of work and it was a challenge to do, but that's what led me into teaching. If I hadn't written that book, I don't think I would have been able to break into teaching this at the university level because I don't have an advanced degree. I just have loads of experience. And then the fact that I've written a book on the subject that was fairly well received, I think helped me open that door for me. So again, not a plan, but it just happened. I feel very fortunate that way.
Yeah, it sounds like you hit all the right points at the right time. Let's talk a little bit about comics real quick. You worked in comics for a while, and that's, a totally different medium to tell a story. How is writing a story for comics different than video games or novels?
In comics, so I mentioned the riding the bull metaphor for being a game writer, that the kind of hang on for dear life as this thing continues to change and try to kick you off and gore you pretty much, you being the story and the story element. So the metaphor I use for a comic book writer is if you've ever done one of those where your leg is strapped to another person's leg and then you run together, it's that kind of close collaboration between you and a penciler, you know, a team, and telling a story together. And I worked at Marvel during the days of what we called the Marvel method of visual storytelling, which is the writer would write what's called a plot. The plot would basically describe what's happening in an issue of a comic book, but not down to the panel level. In other words, you know, you would say on pages 1 to 2, this stuff happens, and they talk about this, but you wouldn't put actual dialogue in. You would just describe the scenes, and then it would go to the penciler. The penciler would take this plot and break it into 22 pages of art, and they would choose the camera angles. They would choose how many panels per page, And they didn't have the dialogue yet. So they knew the gist of what was being said. So then the penciler would do this, and then it would come back to the writer to then react to this and write the dialogue based on what they're seeing. So it was a real collaborative process. I think most comics these days, they've switched over to the what was called the full script method, where the writer says page one, panel one, this, and here's the dialogue for it. It's very prescriptive, and I'm not a big fan of that approach, because I think it puts the visual storytelling mostly on the writer's back, where I think the artist is probably better equipped to play director, visual director, than the writer. But anyway, that was, so it was very collaborative, and you had to be thinking long-term because it's serialized, it's episodic, so every issue is usually part of a longer story. I mean, if you have an arc of three issues, there's still threads that are going along for a year to the future, whatever. Whereas with games, obviously, a lot of things I mentioned before, the challenges of the changing landscape, the letting someone into your story that wants to have control of the story, and how do you make them feel like they have control of the story, but not really give them control of your story? How do you account for the variables that could happen in a scene? Who might be dead? What things have happened that the player affected that this scene has to take account for? How many versions of the scene do I need to write, depending on what the player did? There was a time during development of Mua 2, I print out this giant spreadsheet on my office wall with all the characters in the game and all the things that happened to them over the course of the game, because I was worried that at some point there was going to be a cutscene that would play with a character in it who had already died in one version of the story. And I was paranoid about this happening. I was sure it was going to happen. So I was like really keeping track of all these characters. And writers of novels have their cork boards and their cards, and so do people in a writer's room for TV or a movie. But the additional part is the variance and the things that can change along the way and how to make sure you don't mess that up. So something you do here isn't contradicted 6 hours later. So there's definitely overlap, but, and of course the budgetary aspect of comics, you know, even though, yes, we can do anything in comic we want to, but if I ask the artist to draw a million individual spaceships, each with a different design, the artist will come find me the same way that the 3D modelers will find me in the game. Whereas in a novel, do what you want. It's you against the road. The novelist metaphor I use is the long distance runner, because you're basically you against the road, right? There's no one. You're competing against yourself, against the time you can do it in. That's each one is its own thing. But yeah, I enjoyed my time in comics very much. I look back on it fondly because it feels very simple compared to what I do now, in terms of not easy, but just simpler in terms of the things I need to think about and the kind of the lower barriers to get to my audience. Like when I was writing for Marvel, if I wrote it and it got into a comic book, it had to get past my editor and past the editor in chief. And once it got past those two people, it was out into the world. And it was, and if the artist drew what I hoped they would draw, it would basically be what I envisioned. Whereas on a game team, you are just one small piece of a much larger machine. And so you have to be okay with that.
And I think that's fascinating, because I always pictured writing for comic books like writing a script for a movie. You plot it all out and then they go draw it. But at least at the time, it was much more collaborative. So to me, it seems like comics were almost partway between writing a novel and writing a video game.
There are definitely some similarities like that. Again, not having full control over, for example, the visuals. So sometimes there'd be an artist who didn't draw what I asked, or they misunderstood, and we have to decide what to do about it. Do I have to write around it, or do I beg the editor to have an artist send it back to the artist, or have a correction artist in the studio tweak it? Those are things that won't happen in a novel. Although if your editor comes in a novel, you may be dealing with a very different kind of challenge there. And we all have editors. But there definitely are some things that working in comics helped me prepare to write for games. But again, there's all these other things that you just have to kind of learn as you go, or read about it in books, or just experience it. So I try to prepare my students by experiencing the kind of things that they will run across in writing for games and doing narrative design that are hard to describe otherwise, other than just being in it.
Got it. I know right now there's a big push for serial fiction, and I've got all these author friends writing serial fiction, learning about it and asking about it. And I'm like, guys, go grab some comic books and read some comics. That's been serial fiction for 80 years.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, today's TV is all episodic now, too. So thinking long term and leaving doors open for yourself, and also letting yourself discover things along the way that you didn't know were there until you got down into the weeds. That was always a big part of what I had to learn as an editor working at Marvel. Was we would plan out, the writer would plan out 6 months ahead, and we would talk, okay, this issue, this is going to happen. And okay, do that. And, you know, they'd have the beats of each issue kind of laid out for 6 months or a year ahead of time. And then the plot would come in, and I'd be like, well, wait a minute, this isn't what we agreed on. But I wouldn't just go, well, give me what we agreed on. I'd be like, well, let me see what we got here. because they discovered that once they got down into the nitty-gritty, that there were better things they could do. And so that balance between discovery and having a plan, so you don't want to end up working on an episodic thing that doesn't know where it's going, like, for example, Lost or Battlestar Galactica, you know, yes. Both of which had a good following for a while and then kind of fell to pieces, or Game of Thrones, you know, which kind of, you know, had such a great run until that last season, and clearly did not know what to do. You can feel it as an audience member. So for myself as a writer, I kind of, you know, would work ahead, but things impact your series that you don't anticipate, you know, crossovers and editorial edicts and whatnot. So when I was writing a book called New Warriors, and it was a team
book
of teen heroes. Oh, thanks.
It's one of my favorites.
I included a character that really was pushing my luck, and that was a character named Time Slip. And the idea of her power was that she could swap consciousness with herself from a future version of herself. So they would swap places. So as a little girl, she would get these visions and literally transport herself to when she was 20-something years old in the middle of a random situation, and she would be terrified because she was a five-year-old girl. And meanwhile, her 20-year-old self would be in her five-year-old body for a few minutes. So this character became part of the team, and she would try to look to the future to see what was going to happen. So I had to kind of show images, and the trick of the character was these weren't like potential things that would happen. The hook was if she saw it, it was going to happen, which meant I was putting these serious stakes on the ground for my future issues that I had to pay off on. And I always had to kind of reorient myself into that very, you know, that exact same panel that I showed 6 issues earlier, that things have changed since then. I still got to get there. And so leaving those doors open for myself, there was one scene where she's desperately trying to see what's going to happen. So she just tries again and again. And we showed like 6 panels on one page of different things that we were going to have happen the next year of the book. And one of the panels was like, I don't even know what I was thinking with that one. What am I going to do? How am I going to get to that one? And I eventually was able to reinterpret the visual so it was the opposite of what you thought was happening, because it just didn't work for where things had gone. So that balance of course, having a plan, but also not being so rigidly locked into it that you don't open yourself up to discovery along the way.
Yeah, I must say, someday, if I come out your way, I will bring some video games and comics and find you to sign both. That I've gotten.
I'd be happy to do that. It may raise the value by maybe $1.
Yeah, so, well, yeah. Mine are pretty well read and used. My son read most of mine, so they're not really all high value collected stuff in cases. We enjoyed them through the years.
That's good to hear. Yeah, I much prefer to hear that than things have been polybagged and never read.
Yeah, that, I don't get that. Whatever.
it happened.
Yeah. Well, my son works at a comic book store now. So he's, you know, right in the thick of it. I keep hearing how all these things going on in the industry and very chaotic almost. Of course, then I see video games. So who knows?
Yeah, it is definitely a dynamic, is the word I try to use. Dynamic landscape when you're working in it. Very dynamic.
Well, Evan, it's been really great talking to you. I've loved this about the comics, video games, and I appreciate all your time. We've run over a bit. Our tech problems. So before we go, is there any last minute things you would tell the writers out there if they're looking into comics or video games?
Well, we talked about, you know, the breaking into games and, you know, making sure that you don't just say, I want to be a game writer and nothing else, and that's what I'm going to do. It's a very, very difficult track to rest. So I would, again, try to, you know, learn something else that's an important role in games, maybe a more common role, and make sure that you're qualified to apply for those jobs competitively. But with that secret superpower of yours being narrative, which you can unveil kind of once you're there, once you're within those walls, because trying to break in, you know, purely as a game writer is just so challenging. I see so many people banging their heads against the wall. My own students have a very hard time, you know, getting that first job. I've been lucky enough to see a couple of them actually succeed, which I tell them going in, you know, we're going to train you to be game designers and first, and this is why. And so we try to kind of make sure they understand that I would never run a game writing program that was only focused on game writing. It wouldn't be fair to people paying for that. So, and I would also say just in general with writing, you know, one thing I've learned over the years is if you have a great idea for a story and you don't write it, someone else will. Happens over and over.
Yeah.
I take too long to write it. I have it in my head. for years. And then I see a movie come out and yeah, there it is. Or an episode of a TV show. Yep, there it is. So if you've got what you feel is a great idea and you aren't actually executing on it, then trust me, if you leave it long enough, you'll watch someone else do it instead. So is that something you want to have happen? That's probably one of the biggest takeaways I've learned from many years of watching that happen to me. Because I mentioned the whole laziness thing, right? Yeah.
So what if somebody's listening and would like to go to school and come take your classes and learn game design and game writing? Anything to tell them before they sign up and come out there?
I mean, no, the school is University of Silicon Valley, usv.edu. And right on that site, you'll find the game writing concentration within the programs. So you can check it out and ask more questions if you have them. In terms of preparation for that, I mean, we take you from wherever you are to hopefully being prepared to go out into the world. So we don't assume anything. We don't assume you've used Unity. We don't assume you've done anything. But of course, the more you've done, the better job you're going to do hitting the ground running. But we don't assume that you've, I mean, when you apply to that position, particular concentration, you will have to submit a writing sample, several writing samples. This is not just to gauge whether we feel that you're at a level where we can bring you up to that next level. So basically, command of language, good ideas, or just kind of basic handle on writing. It's not like you have to be a professional level writer to enter the program. It's an undergraduate program. So, but in the meantime, if someone's too young to enter college, and it is a 4-year degree, it's a BA. For the game, it's actually part of what we call the game design art side of things. We have game design art and game design engineering. One is more technical than the other side, and that's currently being shuffled. But if you're at the age where you're looking at colleges, then yeah, I definitely would love to hear from you and see what happens. But in the meantime, yeah, there are tools out there that we can practice these things and get a handle for interactive writing and what's involved. Twine is a great way to begin to see. This possibility space and also the extra work that comes in if you start branching your story over and over.
Yeah, I've actually been messing around with Twine a little bit myself. So I like that one. Cool. All right. Well, Evan, thank you very much. You've been very gracious and I love the talk and all the info. It's been great.
My pleasure. Great questions too.
Cool. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Discovered Wordsmiths. Come back next week and listen to another author discuss the road they've traveled, and maybe, sometime in the near future, it might be you.